From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And my first guest today is a fixture of the poetry scene in Chicago, Illinois. Mark Turcotte first made a name for himself there in the 1990s, winning the inaugural Gwendolyn Brooks Open Mic Poetry Award in 1993. He was later selected as a significant Illinois poet, and then he was awarded the 1997 Josephine Gates Kelly Memorial Fellowship from the Wordcraft Circle of Native Writers and Storytellers. He's also the author of several books, including The Feathered Heart, Songs of Our Ancestors, and Exploding Chippewas. Most recently, he's been a senior lecturer and distinguished writer-in-residence at DePaul University's English Department. And now he has been named the 6th Poet Laureate of Illinois. His 4-year term is set to begin July 1st. In order to make our schedules work, I spoke with Turcotte Tuesday afternoon. Because of that, no calls this hour, but you can let us know what you think by emailing talk@21stshow.org. All right, Mark Turcotte, congratulations on becoming Poet Laureate. Welcome to the 21st Show.
Thanks a lot, Brian. And I also appreciate you getting all the facts straight, especially about my tenure beginning on the 21st, or excuse me, on the July 1st. And then also just in general, reaching out. I appreciate it very much. I appreciate your interest, obviously.
Well, thank you so much for making time to be with us. I want to begin by asking you, what is your earliest memory of writing?
Oh, that's a really easy one for me because I've been thinking about it forever and people have been asking me a similar question for a long time. But it has to do with a Yogi Bear coloring book that I had when I was a kid on the reservation. I'd colored all the pictures and all the different ways that I could, and I just began reading the captions in the coloring book, you know, on the captions on all the different black line drawings. And so it became like a book for me. And because I had an older sister who was learning to read, I kind of learned to read just by osmosis, like by hanging out with her. And so I began really early. But that's it. My first real reading experience was in that coloring book.
Do you have a sense that writing is something someone could do is their sort of main thing in life, for lack of a better term?
No. Especially, you know, coming, you know, as a kid coming from where I came from, you know, I got out, and even after I got off the reservation and out into the so-called white world, you know, white America, and school systems and stuff there, no one ever put books in front of me that were written by Native people. They tried to put a lot of books in front of me that were supposedly about Native people. But they were always written by somebody else, and I could usually tell right away. And actually, it wasn't until, I was in high school before I had a teacher who was kind enough to mention to me that there was a Pulitzer Prize winner who was Native, and that was M. Scott Mamaday. And that just opened up a world for me, just the idea that, oh, there are real Native people who've written books, and then have been celebrated for it. And it just kind of suddenly became a possibility.
So you've mentioned a couple of times where you came from. Tell us about the Turtle Mountain Chippewa Reservation in North Dakota.
Well, it's a tiny little reservation right on the North Dakota-Canadian border, just south of an international garden called the International Peace Gardens, which is a real symbol of peace between the U.S. and Canada, of course. And the only people who seem to have ever heard of it are the people who live in North Dakota and the people right across the border in Canada. I've had a couple people ask me, you know, about living there. And I have to say, you know, very firmly that I haven't lived there since I was a kid. I've visited a few times, obviously. I still have connections out there. I have friends who are Turtle Mountain, like I am, the great famous Native writer Louise Erdrich and her younger sister Hyde are both Turtle Mountain people. So we seem to have something in the water or something going on up there. But actually, I just found out recently that the recent North Dakota Poet Laureate was Denise Lage Medire, who is a Turtle Mountain person. And then Hyde was a Poet Laureate of Minneapolis, I think, for a couple of years. And for a while, the Montana State Poet Laureate was a person who has connections to Turtle Mountain. So there seems to be a lot of us floating around out there.
You talk about, you know, where you came from and leaving. Mm-hmm. It's when we're young, especially, I think we don't really understand that our lives are not necessarily, that everybody doesn't just have a similar life to the one we do. When did you, or did you appreciate that? And how did that understanding come to you over time?
Well, because I'm a mixed blood person, my mother was, I always like to describe her as a Scots-Irish mid-Michigan farm girl, because that's how she always described herself. She and my father made me, I was actually born in Michigan, but pretty much immediately after I was born, he took us out to Turtle Mountain. But there were times when, you know, my mother would go back and we'd visit Michigan, and I was very aware of the difference between the two worlds. They were very much two worlds, you know, that cliche about walking around two worlds, that, you know, when the worlds are that different, they are distinctly two worlds. And I also had the experience when I was a child, we would leave the reservation and travel out west to work in the migrant camps. So I experience travel across America. And while I didn't do a lot of interacting with America and Americans, you know, I got to look out the windows of the car and see the differences in the world. And I was so amazed. I remember being so amazed and fascinated by the kids that I encountered in the migrant camps, who were mostly of Mexican-American extraction. And, you know, they often spoke, you know, the Spanish and stuff, and just fascinated the heck out of me. But no matter the fact, we couldn't speak to each other, we could play together really well. So those images are really strong for me. One of my strongest images ever as a writer, as a poet, comes from a day in a migrant camp in Idaho. So I guess, I mean, one of the reasons I'm a writer and I'm a poet and I'm an artist is because I've been paying attention. You know, I think that's a thing that's true among artists. And I've just been seeing and observing and I think trying to understand, you know, ever since I got here, you know, so.
Noticing. I'm trying to think of who it is that says that word, noticing, about writers. Maybe this is a good time to ask you if you'd be willing to share one of your poems with us.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Well, since I just brought it up, how about if I talk about, now, this is actually my origin poem. It's about how my mother and father met. My father wandered into a diner where she was working in Lansing, Michigan, when he was there visiting family from the res who had relocated to the factory cities of Michigan for work and stuff. This is called Horse and Cradle. She, white woman, fell in love with the black wave of his hair, with the way his voice rose up out of him from the earth, the way his flirtatious hands fell over the strings of his guitar. She fell, white woman, in love with the points of his eyes, the soft circles they cut through her shoulders, with the way that he came to her bed, dressed in savage feathers, her bed where she climbed upon his copper-brown horse of a back, where she carried the arrow in her heart, and she became my mother, the gently, ever gently rocking cradle. Thanks.
Yeah, that is evocative. Talk about, that's interesting. I got to say, that's interesting imagery to say about one's own mother. I wonder if you can talk about the genesis of that poem.
That's funny. You're not the first person to react like that. Back in the 90s, when I arrived in Chicago, I got very involved in the performance scene, spoken word scene, the slam scene at the Green Mill Lounge and places like that. And I read this poem on stage. I'd read it before, like during an open mic or something. But the woman who was visiting there, she was the feature that night, was from the West Coast. She was a Black American writer, really ebullient and a tremendous performer. And after my open mic, I went outside on the sidewalk and she came outside and she said, "I've never in my life heard a man talk about his origins in such explicit ways." I mean, she was really fascinated by that. And it didn't dawn on me that that was an odd thing for me to do until she pointed it. And she didn't say it was bad, but it just, I've always spoken in that way, you know, matter of factly and honestly. And I think it's important, you know, it's part of who I am. It's part of my story. And stories for we Native people, especially our origin stories, are very important, you know, because so many people have been trying to identify us and define us and represent us in ways that are not flattering and appropriate or even close to accurate. So it's really important to us. And I wasn't even aware of how evocative that could be to somebody else. So now, how many years later, 30 years later, you're a little taken aback by it too. So
I wouldn't say taken aback, struck. Yeah, I don't wanna, no judgment. I will, yeah. I understand for a time you sort of lost your passion for writing, and maybe this poem, this period of your life we've been talking about, the Green Mill and so on, sort of re-sparked it. Can you talk about that journey into the wilderness, if you will?
I mean, all through my childhood and into my teen years and in the high school, I ended up leaving and, the reservation, kind of finishing my growing, the second half of my growing up in the so-called white world in mid-Michigan around Lansing and stuff. And I was always the writer. I was always the poet. All of my teachers knew it and they noticed it and they tried really hard to help me with that and help me, recognize that in myself, even sometimes as limited as they were about, like the native side of who I was and stuff. They tried really hard. I wouldn't have made it without amazing teachers, all through my, my growing up. But then, I got out of high school. I kind of wasted 1 year at college, not really knowing what to do with myself, and ended it up. This is like the time when the Rust Belt, Michigan and Illinois and the Midwestern states were kind of in trouble, for jobs. And I ended up, just kind of traveling the country, working different jobs here and there, skilled and semi-skilled labor. And there was no room for poetry and reading in that world. And I kind of just lost touch with a large part of myself because of that, just out of practical circumstances of needing to like feed myself and things like that. And it, wasn't until I landed back in Chicago again that I suddenly found myself in this really amazing, thriving environment where people were like, how do you live without words and reading and books and, writing and, and it literally, Chicago saved me in a lot of ways, and
Something
certainly
that,
changed
yeah.
the life I was living.
Something that maybe I think might be underappreciated about Chicago by people who are not, of tribal ancestry is that it is one of the largest urban centers of Native Americans. I think 175 different tribes I've read are represented there. Has that been a part of your story and how you came to think of yourself and help form your writing?
Well, Brian, I'm not trying to just blow smoke in your ear, but it's like you and I had a pre-interview to set this up because the other aspect of my landing in Chicago was how I reconnected with my nativeness, which I had kind of lost contact with. It's sometimes in America, it's just better not to be native. And there are times in some of our lives, especially when we're disconnected from a community, when it's just kind of easier not to be native in America. And people didn't always identify me as native. Often, when I was in the Southwest, other brown people suspected I was native and often asked me about it. But coming to Chicago, I met the amazing poet, Eddie Two Rivers, who was kind of the native poet of Chicago back in the 90s. He took me around to readings and was very kind to me, brought me in, into the scene, introduced me to the American Indian Center. And it was the first time since I, had lived on the reservation that I spent so much time in and among other Native people. And of course, they're from all over the country. They've come up from all over the country to, end up in Chicago. So those two things are connected. My rediscovering my love of words and writing, and in a way, re-recognizing, my own origins and my nativeness.
I'm interested if you can speak more about, you said sometimes it's better to not be seen as a native, an indigenous person. Can you say
Well,
more about that?
yeah, sure. I mean, it's a delicate thing, I'm talking about the 90s specifically here, but all through, my growing up, 60s, 70s, 80s, to be native was a real curiosity. It was an exotic thing for your average American. There was a sort of like the hippie movement in America was essentially a bunch of, pardon the expression, white people kind of playing Indian, their version of Indian a little bit. and the whole, Earth Day being connected to the Earth movement, was, a reaction to those impulses. So sometimes if you mentioned that you were native, you suddenly became this like curiosity to people, and unfortunately it hasn't changed an awful lot in America, except I'm just, more willing to be who I am in the world, and it still can be awkward and uncomfortable sometimes, to people, because I don't think America still really has much awareness or understanding of Native people,
That is such an
at
interesting
least not
formulation.
accurate understandings.
Yeah, so it's such an interesting formulation, the idea that the hippies were playing at being Native American. It's maybe a testament to my own ignorance, but I had never heard that before. That's fascinating. All right, we're going to take a break. Sorry, we're going to take a break on the program. When we come back, we will continue our conversation with Mark Turcotte, who is going to be, as of this summer, Illinois' sixth Poet Laureate. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's get back to my conversation with Mark Turcotte, who will this summer be Illinois' sixth Poet Laureate. He's also a senior lecturer and a distinguished writer in residence at the DePaul University Department of English. I spoke with him on Tuesday afternoon. Because of that, no calls, but you can let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. Before the break, we were talking about this idea of people sort of playing at being Native American and, the sort of as it was expressed in the hippie culture of America. Right now it is still an active political conversation in Illinois in the General Assembly this very year about whether high schools and school sports teams should, be disallowed from using Native American symbolism and names as their mascots. I wonder, since this is such a contemporary issue, if you can speak to that and your perception as somebody who has, as you said, been in both worlds.
Sure. I mean that's the hot button issue, and it's always the hot button issue, and it's a frankly discussion I've been having ever since I can remember. There seems to be an attitude in America of like, well, why is this suddenly a problem for Native people? And it's just because they don't realize that it's been a problem for us forever, but they just haven't been listening, or we haven't had, voices that were being paid attention to, or, that we had, we had access to expressing ourselves. And frankly, now we're writing more books and making more movies and making more TV shows and plays and art and dance and everything. So, we're expressing ourselves in every way. And this issue, it's often people say to us, like, don't you have more important things to worry about? And that condescending, patronizing attitude about it is just aggravating. But it also is a signal, because when we say back to them, well, if it's not that important, then why are you so desperately defending the use of these mascots? People get really vehemently angry with me sometimes when I suggest that the Chicago Blackhawks is racist and should be, added to the dustbins of history and things like that. I mean, so it must mean something to them too. And basically my stance on this is that once you make a mascot out of a group of people, you've made them into a cartoon. And none of us ever say, hey, let's honor people by turning them into cartoons. So the argument that we're honoring people, we're honoring a history. I mean, there are often people who are from communities where all the Native people were wiped out and moved elsewhere, who say, but it's our history. And you say back to them, but it's not the people whose history these images aren't here anymore. They were driven away. They were eliminated. But they somehow claim that it's their history, you know, in some way. But without, you know, and once you turn people into cartoons, how can you ever really respect them ever? You know, there's a reason that the American Psychological Association has talked about how bad this is for Native children. You know, this image, you know, this, you know, allowing these images and mockeries, you know, to happen. And that's the one of the problems. People will say, well, it's not, you know, it's not the mascot or the Blackhawks' fault or whatever, that people dress up like Indians and wear war paint and do tomahawk chops and go woo 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 and stuff like that, you know. And I say, well, it's not necessarily the Blackhawks' fault, but without the team to cheer for and dress up for and the mascot, they wouldn't be doing it. So it's not very genuine, you know, generous, or excuse me. Not you're not being, you know, genuine if you say that you really think, you know, that the mascot isn't responsible for the behavior. And anytime people dress up like you, drunkenly act like you, it's not an honorable thing. You know, so without the mascots, there's no reason for people to behave like that, essentially.
I know this is not an issue unique to Illinois. I've never lived anywhere else. I know there are other places and
Right.
other states that have this as well. But I do wonder if, as you said, well, it's been centuries since Native Americans were, in many ways, driven out of Illinois. In fact, just in the last year, there is the first federally recognized tribal land in Illinois, the Prairie Band Potawatomi, have that. And I wonder if that sort of misunderstood lack of presence, if you will, or lack of awareness of presence is part of the story.
Well, you know, I do want to make sure that I'm saying I don't really believe that most of this is, you know, intentionally insulting. You know, I don't think people's intent is to be offensive. But sometimes when you start suggesting that it is offensive, then they get offensive. You know what I mean? And then their intent is to be offensive. I've had people just sort of stand in front of me and say, well, I'm never going to give up my mascot, and I'm glad you're offended by it. And you know, I mean, it's like the place that they the hole that they crawl into, you know, to defend things. But most of it is, you know, about a misunderstanding. Usually, if I can stand in front of a room full of 20 or 30 people and talk about mascots, usually people can walk out of that room with a pretty good understanding of how Native people feel about it, and they have a better sense of it, you know. But unfortunately, those conversations aren't really happening anywhere. I mean, I've seen sports shows, ESPN and these things, you know, they talk about racism in sports and this and that, and then they say, so then how did the Chiefs do today? Without any awareness at all of what they're saying, you know, like now we're going to talk about a team that does tomahawk chops, and there's also this attitude of like, well, can we negotiate how offensive or how racist we can be toward you? The Chiefs team actually said things like, well, our fans love the tomahawk chop, so we don't, you know, want them to stop doing that, but we'll ask them, please don't dress up in goofy headdresses when you come to the games. Please don't paint your face in red face. You know, red face is equivalent to blackface, whether people like it or not. And then it's odd to say, I, you know, a wonderful poet that I know, African American poet, said to me, Mark, are they really trying to negotiate like how much they can be racist? We'll get rid of this, but we want to keep the tomahawk chop. And I said, yeah, for some reason they feel like they can negotiate this thing. And he said, they would never do that with African Americans. They would never do that with, you know, him. So why would, you know, he was just completely flummoxed by the concept. It's really, it people love their native mascots. It's really an amazing phenomenon in America. You know, and it's frustrating. You know.
Yeah. Well, thank you for following me down that path. I do appreciate
Yeah,
it. I
it's
do.
not as much fun as we could have been having.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, maybe on that note, maybe we can return to another poem if you're willing to share one.
Okay, well, this poem is called Battlefield, and it's kind of a representative of like how I write poems often, which is I begin with an image. In this case, I just had this memory of my sister and myself standing on a sidewalk on the reservation outside of a pool hall, a bar, and we were just kind of looking in the door, watching the men in their shoot pool, battlefield. Back when I used to be Indian, I am standing outside the pool hall with my sister. She, strawberry blonde. Stale sweat and beer pours through the open door. A warrior leans on his stick, fingers blue with chalk. Another bends to shoot. His braids brush the green felt, swinging to the beat of the jukebox. We move away. Hank Williams falls again in the back seat of a Cadillac. I look back. A wind off the distant hills lifts my shirt, brings the scent of wounded horses.
What do you hope to achieve as poet laureate?
Well, the first thing I want to do is continue the legacy. It's a really impressive legacy when you look at that list of amazing names. And the fact that, you know, in the history of the state, I'm only the sixth laureate says a lot about what the position and the people who've held the position have meant in the state. Illinois takes it very seriously. My understanding of it is, you know, things kind of, you know, the laureate sort of wasn't getting the attention that it should have for a while. And the first lady, M.K. Pritzker, was very active in helping to create a process to actually name another poet laureate, which was Angela Jackson 4 years ago. So the first thing for me to do is to kind of like not drive it into the ditch, you know. You know, I'm joking, but it's kind of true too. Like, don't ruin this thing. A lot of people have worked very hard at this. But I do, and you know, just like everybody else, it's got to be, you know, aimed at young people. My primary belief is that, you know, poetry and writing and art and though anything in art is about expressing oneself. And young people need more and more and more venues to express themselves. And then, and venues also that, where someone is willing to guide them a little bit. You know, I think they have a lot of access to places to express themselves where they might not have sort of the guidance that they need. So I'm willing to do that and find other people who are willing to help me do that. I really like the idea of collaboration. And allowing, you know, making a space for young people to say who they are, you know, because as a native person, you know, I am someone who's been part of, you know, comes from a group of people who've been trying to express who we are for a long, long time and sort of being denied the opportunity. And now that we're doing it full steam, it's just unbelievable, the beauty of it all, how remarkable it is, you know, to see it you know, happen. So why not pass that around to everybody, you know? I really believe in giving people the opportunity to speak what they are thinking and feeling and seeing in our world.
Well, Mark Turcotte, sixth poet laureate of Illinois, congratulations on that. Thank you so much for sharing some of your work and your story with us today on the 21st Show.